Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark. This is a show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our featured guest on Bookmark today is nature writer Mark Cocker, here to talk about his book, A Claxton Diary. We'll also hear from novelist Jill Dawson on what it's like being a judge for the Costa Book Awards. And poet Hannah Walker talks about being writer in residence at the Cambridge Biomedical Campus. But Mark, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark.
Well, lovely to be here, Lee.
Nice to have you with us. And we're talking to Hannah Walker later. She's a poet. And your book about nature is so poetic, so beautifully written. Similes and metaphors, just breathtaking. Range of vocabulary and your imagination, astonishing. Did you always want to be a writer?
I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I did English at university. And once you finish your degree, you have to make a choice about your life path. And I didn't have many choices because I didn't know what I wanted to do. But writing just became an option, and I've worked at it for 30 years. And I think I'm doing what I want to do, but I would never suggest that I'm a natural writer. You know, I have met writers out of whom it just pours, but I always liken it to lugging out timber from my head. I try and make it seem as if it's effortless, but it never is.
And a lot of it is observational about the world around you. When do you write this? Do you write it as you're observing it, or do you go home? Does the fact that you know you're going to be writing about it spoil the moment? You know, you're always thinking, oh, can you actually enjoy the moment? Or are you thinking how you might put it on the page?
Yes, it's a strange thing, because one is in nature, and most people are just simply immersed in the natural process of reacting to it. And I have to, as it were, intercede as a professional to gather material. But actually, I find that being forced to convert it into money, if you like, or into a job and an income, is a very fruitful experience, because I take detailed notes. And in fact, if I don't take detailed notes, I can't recover the nuance of my encounter as well. I mean, there is a congruence between being a naturalist and being an author. Both are fundamentally dependent upon observation. I've got about 80 notebooks, which I've kept as a continuous narrative of my experience since I was 13. The notebooks are pivotal to my work, absolutely essential. I always have a notebook. In fact, I'm getting worse. I'm surrounded by more and more notebooks. And I love the process of trying to capture what I see in real time and then convert it into something at leisure. But that process of intersecting the sense experience is a very important part of my writing practice.
And you do use all the senses on your descriptions.
Yes, I'm just collaborating with some musicians. I have been entranced by the sound of nature, what's called the biophony, the kind of orchestral symphony of sounds which nature creates around us. And I have been, I suppose, particularly sensitive to that. Although I'm not a musician, the music I love is the music of nature itself. That's something I'm very attached to, and I'm very excited to be working with musicians, because it gives a new dimension of collaboration and focus on birdsong. But I love the song of everything, insects and toads and frogs and things.
And you've chosen three pieces of music for us today. So as you're saying, music is very important to you. When do you listen to it?
When I'm writing properly, I have to have more or less complete silence. But when I'm not in creative mode and I'm just ticking through the emails and all the administrative stuff, I just have music playing all the time. I absolutely love music.
And this first choice, it's Hegira by Joni Mitchell. Why have you chosen this one?
Well, I think it's the greatest piece of modern music. Mitchell is the astonishing lyricist, and the song is a duo or a dialogue between a jazz bass guitarist called Jaco Pastorius and Joni Mitchell's astonishingly beautiful voice in her young period, and I think this is probably her most beautiful song. I remember when I was first encountered it in the 1980s when I was at university, every time I played it, I had that physical sensation of it affecting my body, and it still has that kind of effect. But I think the song, the music, the lyrics, the perfect, perfect modern song by a great artist.
I'm traveling in some vehicle a defector from the petty wars, but shall shut love away. There's comfort in melancholy.
That was Hujira by Joni Mitchell, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our featured guest, Mark Cocker. Mark is an author, naturalist and environmental activist. Crow Country, published in 2007, was shortlisted for the Samuel Johnson Prize and won the New Angle Prize for Literature. Claxton, published in 2014, a collection of daily observations on the wildlife and nature around his home in the village of Claxton, Norfolk, was similarly shortlisted for numerous awards. And in 2019, its companion book, A Claxton Diary, Further Field Notes from a Small Planet, won the East Anglian Book of the Year Award. BBC Wildlife magazine described it as exquisite, essential reading, and the Mail on Sunday called it a spellbinding nature diary that's up there with the greatest. It is a wonderful book, Mark. I absolutely enjoyed reading it. We'll talk about the diary format in just a moment and the way you chose to structure the book. But you refer back in the book to your interest in nature growing up in Derbyshire. This has been a lifelong passion for you, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. I mean, it's been, in terms of my personal life, you know, nature has been there almost every waking hour, but it developed from the age of about 12 or 13 into a lifelong preoccupation. And then I've been able to use it as a sort of subject matter, if you like, for my writing. And yes, I think there is a deep convergence between writing and being a naturalist. You know, being a naturalist is entirely about being sensitized to the world around us, not letting things slip by, but diagnosing and analyzing and checking what you're seeing and being observant. And the writing has been a way of expressing those observations that I've made.
And was there a particular moment in regard to nature where you felt that connection, you felt that pull?
My parents were very good to me because they bought me loads of encyclopedias. I had this kind of in my head encounter with nature, which was mainly through books as a child. And then it switched over into being out in the field. And now, I mean, I love books about nature and particularly field guides and books that are directly about nature. But being in the field is now the primary encounter that I love most of all. I mean, just being out in nature is, yeah, my deepest fulfillment. Fulfillment outside of family and friends. I live for it. I love it, you know.
And this vast knowledge that you have about nature, this vocabulary, is that where it comes from, those books and that learning that you did with your parents when you were young?
My particular kind of nature writing is not about myself. I don't particularly intrude myself. It's about using the information about life outside of ourselves, the world of wildlife, as a set of subjects through which light is refracted, through which I refract my own observation and sensitivity. So my writing is primarily about the otherness of life and other parts of life. I steep myself in trying to understand. I mean, the one thing that I would say is, you know, the idea of being expert is ludicrous, because the more you go on, the more you realize you know absolutely nothing. So there's this curious paradox that you're treated more as somebody who knows something about nature, and you're more and more aware that you know absolutely nothing, and the time's running out. You've got to get more, observe it even more and more. So I felt a great charge of excitement in nature as a child, and I think the important thing is it just got deeper.
And A Claxton Diary, it's called a diary. The format spreads over a year, but within each of those months, you include extracts written in different years. So January, as we move through January, you might actually move backwards and forwards in time. Why did you choose that particular structure?
What I'd really ideally like to have done is have an entry for every day of the year. But the moment when I said something meaningful might not have been in chronological order. I might have encountered something in 2014, which was much more powerfully expressed than something said earlier. So I structured it by month so that each day is chronologically sequential, but not necessarily the year. And what I wanted to do was capture the highlights, but at the same time portray the calendrical cycle that one experiences as we travel around the sun, to capture something of that extraordinary cosmic journey which our country takes through its seasons. The seasons, they are like different countries each time. And so I wanted to capture how standing in one place, standing still and not moving at all, is really moving endlessly. One is constantly confronted with new things every single day. And the diary format captures the magic of the daily experience.
And when you were putting it together, did you notice certain changes or similarities or preoccupations?
There's a degree. I mean, I had to answer a charge that I talked about the same thing several times. But what I argued in my preface or my foreword to the second volume is that that repetition is important. You know, we're obsessed in the West with novelty. You know, the moment we've done something, we want to do something different. And all spiritual practice, all great practice, all apprenticeships are about repetition. And it is about understanding the nuance of difference which occurs in repeated experience that is part of the great learning. You know, if you're going to study yoga or a martial art, you don't do it just once. You have to do it on a daily basis. And then in exactly the same way, I felt that I could respond to the same wildlife. And each time, tiny little changes, refractions, different kind of nuances of change were revealed to me. And I didn't really worry about there being repetition, but there's quite a lot, for instance, about peregrines, about the sights and sounds of big flocks of wildfowl called widgeon. I mean, there are maybe 13 or 14 pieces about blackbirds. Blackbirds are an eternal source of inspiration to me, and I won't be limited to just talking about them once. So I kind of felt that I had license to say some of the same things.
And what a wildlife environment you live in. I must admit, I'd not heard of Claxton before. It really is rich where you are, isn't it?
The critical thing is it's not part of the very famous parts of Norfolk. It has two highly celebrated landscapes, the Broads and the North Norfolk coast. And the whole point about Claxton really was that although I am on the edge of the Broads and gaze over into a fantastic reserve owned by the Royal Society for Protection of Birds, I actually live on outside of the great areas. And what I wanted to show was that there is an abundance of life really in every village. And that was why I chose Claxton as the title. This unknown village that most people in Norfolk have never heard of is actually the center of the universe if you stood here. I mean, the whole conceit of my work is that you are completely immersed in magic. It's just a case of really looking hard to encounter it. You know, that's why I say it's Field Notes from a Small Planet. It's really trying to capture the cosmic wholeness of life filtered through the lens of one very specific, slightly anonymous small village in Norfolk.
This wholeness of life, as you record it, you also say that part of the reason for doing it is about helping people connect with their own memories, their past, the heritage, the history of the planet.
Yes, I mean, I think everybody has this richness of encounter, and nature writers are very often just retrieving for them from their subconscious very often, or from a sort of unknown part of themselves. You know, we all know what it's like to see spider silk glistening in a September morning. It's just that my job is to recall it for you so you remember the occasion when you saw it.
And you go big and small. So we're sometimes out in the field, and sometimes we're in a hedgerow, and sometimes we're on your lawn.
Yes, well, of course, most of the things that decide life on this planet are unicellular. I mean, half the oxygen you breathe is created by phytoplankton in the sea. And most of the life processes on which we are dependent, the things that create our atmosphere, that defend us from the ultraviolet light of the sun, etc., all these things are really at a bacterial level. And our gross senses as human beings really miss all the extraordinary inner universe that exists on a small scale. So I'm very fixated with things like spiders and flies because I've come to realize how important they are to life. Very often I'm associated with birds, but all birds are is largely insects processed by the bird's alimentary system. You know, they're just respired insects. So I try and show that everything is part of a single system, and that is life itself.
And we're going to hear from Hannah Walker in just a moment. She's a poet on the Cambridge Biomedical Campus. You were awarded a Winston Churchill Travel Fellowship. In my research, I found this out, to study birds in magico-medicinal practices in Benin and Cameroon. Tell me a bit about that. It sounds absolutely fascinating.
Well, I spent 20 years writing two books, one called Birds Botanica and one called Birds and People. And I was very interested in how wildlife has become part of our cultural lexicon and part of our cultural lives. And one of the books explores the global significance of birds in terms of culture. So birds have been projected as gods, as omens of evil. People in these West African countries capture and sell dead owls and use them as a kind of medicine, which is rooted in a kind of magical set of practices that we think are alien and ludicrous, but actually these things existed in Britain and were powerful parts of cultural life. Just to give you one example, in the witch's poem in Macbeth, they confect their spell out of animal parts. You hear this extraordinary list of ingredients: eye of newt and wing of howlet and blind adder's tongue and all these ingredients. And all those animals you still find sold in markets in exactly the same way in West Africa. And they rely upon a kind of associative magic. The idea that the owl is a creature of evil omen, and that if you use it, you can both practice black magic to harm somebody, but also to protect yourself from the actions of witches. And I mean, these beliefs are extraordinary. And if we look into the origins of natural history and of medicine, animals were widely used in this associative symbolic format. And I was fascinated by that. So I got this Winston Churchill Fellowship and I used the material eventually in this book, Birds and People.
Fascinating, Mark. Thank you. Well, we'll come back to you in just a moment, but let's hear from Hannah. Hannah Walker is a poet and theatre maker who has toured extensively in the UK and Europe. She's just finished her first full poetry collection, Acting Natural, and at the end of last year was named as one of the new artists in residence at the Cambridge Biomedical Campus, the area around Adam Brookes Hospital that takes in Cambridge University research facilities and pharmaceutical organisations and companies. When I spoke to Hannah, I asked her what the residency project entailed.
I was really interested in this new developed site at the back of Adam Brookes, this new huge kind of expansive, shiny buildings which have sprung up at the back. The project came about because one day my partner, we were coming into Cambridge and he dropped me off on that back road that sort of runs the circumference around the back of Adam Brookes. And I walked through to get through to the front of Adam Brookes. And I was walking through thinking, wow, this is huge and new, and clearly everyone here is doing amazing work. Like, I could read the names on the front of the buildings. They thought, but I don't really know what they're doing, and I would love to know what they're doing. Like many people in the area, you know, I've spent a lot of time at Adam Brookes over the years. Like, my nieces were born there, my brothers and sisters were born there, my family are all from Shelford. We spend a lot of time in that sort of land area. I've been at Adam Brookes in sort of emotional states of vulnerability when people I love who are in sort of precarious health states and you're not sure if how they're going to be okay or not. And I thought it'd be really lovely. There's something really lovely about the work that's going on in those research organizations, which is hopeful and striving and human, even though it's scientific. It's about people. And quite as a lot of people here are in interim states of emotion, waiting to know how their lives are going to go in some way. And I thought it'd be really lovely to sort of close that gap a little bit, to communicate outside of the building somehow through pieces of artwork what is happening there. So I'm a writer predominantly, but I work in lots of different forms. And I thought how beautiful it would be to sort of have text-based, quite large-scale pieces of artwork in that landscape, so that when you walk through, there are these phrases about the human motivation within the buildings, which speak in a very conversational, direct, accessible language, but it's still poetic. So basically, the pieces that are going to be, I'm going to collaborate with the researchers, we're going to come up with these poetic text phrases which say things like, we are breaking new ground on old land. Each organization will have their own specific thing that they are working to do. It won't say something like, we are looking at stem cell research and da, 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 da. It will look at the hope and the motivation and the human voice underneath that. And then these pieces will be made into large scale light installations.
Wow. So as a writer, as you say, you're used to working in the written medium. So now thinking visually, this is a different experience for you, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one that I've been lucky to have before. I worked with Artichoke, who are really wonderful production company, on a piece which is on the side of Durham Library in the middle of Durham, and we worked with some residents of a maximum security prison, and that was a really interesting project because the brief was it's going to go in this place and be very visible and permanent. huge, massive lettering. It was a neon piece, that one. And this group in this prison who don't necessarily have a connection to that place. And so the challenge with that project was, how do you find an accessible meaning which means something to the participant group that you've worked with and to the person who's walking down the street? But I really like this way of working with the visual, because I love literature and I love books and I make theatre sometimes too, and I love all forms of literature and text. But I think what is really lovely about text in a visual medium is that it's free and it's kind of effortless. It's accessible. And I think it's just about getting the tone right for the pieces so that when you read it, people think, oh, that's for me.
And playing devil's advocate, people might say, look, this is, you know, a desperate time. We're in a pandemic. We're in a lockdown. Do we really need poetry? Do we really need this?
I love it when people play devil's advocate. To be honest, I've been asking myself that question throughout the whole pandemic. Like, what is the role of artists? What is the role of art? There were moments where I thought, yeah, what is the point? Surely it's just about surviving and getting by. And then I realized that myself, when dark moments where I was in lockdown with a five-year-old just going, oh, that actually the thing that I was reaching for comfort was art. That was the thing that sort of made me feel that there was life outside the monotony of a routine, was this beautiful thing which you can do in isolation. You can have some poetry, you can watch something on Netflix. Like, that's theatre in a different form, do you know what I mean? And that these art forms all do still live. So I think we do. I think it's to do with nourishment and being people. And there's something about art which, you know, good art, I always feel you can consume it alone, but it makes you feel like you're part of something that's not just you.
And interesting that you're working with the Cambridge Biomedical Campus, a science environment, because people often think art and science, they're diametrically opposed.
Yeah, and that's been quite interesting in the recruitment process for who's going to take part, because I did an open call out to all the researchers working on site. I've still got some spaces available, but I've been really delighted that those places have just really quickly filled up. And I asked people in the application, why would you like to take part? A really extraordinary number of people said, because I had to choose a path in my career between science or art. And I was like, that's interesting, isn't it, that so many people have those dual talents. And I do wonder if there is instinctive making or creating using a similar bit of the brain or a similar instinct in some way. I suppose it's the instinct. I always think when I'm making a piece of art, what question am I trying to answer? What am I like seeking after? And I wonder with research projects, you're always seeking after trying to move on to the next stage of something. And I wonder if it's that, like trying to get the answer to something.
So you're working with scientists, so that's going to be interesting, isn't it? Looking at how they approach things and bringing that together with your own kind of instinctive, intuitive approach.
Yes. Before I worked as an artist, I used to work for arts organisations as an education facilitator. I was really lucky to have some facilitation training from a really great organisation. And one of the things that they taught me to do was this digging underneath the language that each sector, whatever job you do, has its own language and has its own vocabulary and has its own sort of meanings and understandings and values quite often that sit within those sectors as well. And I was taught this really valuable bit of kit whereby you helps you dig underneath the language of those individual jobs or organisations to find the kind of common meaning that sits in between. So that's one of the pieces of activity that we'll be doing in the workshops, is kind of going, this is the language that you're talking in, but what are you really trying to do? Yeah, I'm really interested in their language and I'm really interested in their specialisms, but I'm particularly interested in, just in the motivations. I think that's what we're trying to get to.
And what an exciting time to be working with scientists. My goodness, we need science at the moment.
Oh my goodness, we really do need science. And I was really interested that quite a few people who had signed up had some hand in working on COVID vaccines or COVID short testing things. And I thought that was a surprise to me, because I thought people who've been doing those jobs, the last thing that they would be able to make time for would be an arts project. But maybe they've worked so hard. Maybe this is the right time in terms of like having something different.
And what about the long outcomes of this? What do you want to leave behind from this residency?
Well, very literally, the pieces on site, the sort of physical outputs, of which there will be three. I believe those are going to be there for up to 3 years. And so I really hope that that adds to the space that people move through. Like, I'm really aware that for some people, Adam Brooks is a place to nip to get milk because it's their nearest shop. Do you know what I mean? People use that space in such a variety of ways. And for some people, it's a very serious space, and some people, it's a workspace. So I hope that those pieces being left there are onward communications of sort of the work that goes on there within those buildings, are sort of bringing it out longer than that. I mean, it feels a bit lofty to say that you presume that it will have any ongoing impact. You always hope it will.
And you can find out more about that residency project at cambridge-biomedical.com. Our featured guest on Bookmark today is nature writer Mark Cocker, talking about his book, A Claxton Diary. Well, let's hear your second choice of music now, Mark, which is Flamenco Sketches by Miles Davis. Why this one?
A Kind of Blue is the biggest selling jazz album of all time. It was written in the year I was born. It was an improvised set of themes that Miles took, and this is the most beautiful. I've been listening to it for 30 years. It feels to me as fresh as the day I first heard it, and I play it every week or some part of it, and this is my favourite song. It's absolutely magnificent.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Cambridge Breakfast with Julian Clover and Lucy Milazzo.
It's the breakfast show that's all about Cambridge. We've got the news.
National and local.
Travel updates.
From the A14 to Milton Bode and all stations to Cambridge.
The people and the places.
Plus guests in our Friday food club.
Cambridge Juice.
All the new things to do in the city.
Our daily quiz.
Oh yes, questions with Lucian.
And all request Jukebox Friday.
And don't forget the coffee.
Cambridge Breakfast with Julian Clover and Lucy Milazzo.
Here with a fresh blend weekday mornings from 7.
What's in your spare room? Christmas decorations? Maybe an old exercise bike? Could you give that room to a young person along with a fresh start? St Christopher's Fellowship is looking for people to become foster carers in Cambridgeshire to provide safe, caring homes for teenagers who need help. And because we've been working to improve young people's lives since 1870, you can trust that you're not on your own. You'll receive regular training, dedicated social worker support, and space to share experiences with other carers. It's more than a spare room, it's a brighter future. Call 0800 234 6282 or visit stchris.org.uk/fostering. St Christopher's, creating brighter futures.
Hi, Pam here. Are you tired of the same old shops? Drop into Fantasia on Mill Road near Parker's Peace. Enter our treasure cave full of fine clothing and exotic homewares. Natural materials, uplifting ambiance, mood improvement guaranteed. Perk up your wardrobe, your home, your life. Dare to shop different. Fantasia, 64 Mill Road, Cambridge. Fantasia.uk.com.
For opening times, please see fantasia.uk.com.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And our featured guest on Bookmark is nature writer Mark Cocker, talking about his book, A Claxton Diary. Mark, what about the different kinds of landscape? You're quite critical in your book of building on landscape spaces, on wild areas. And I described you at the beginning as an environmental activist, which is how you describe yourself. Do the two things go hand in hand, do you think? If you have a love of nature, you have to be political to protect that?
There are many nature writers for whom their personal, emotional and spiritual response to nature is the centre of their practice. There's a famous quote from Bertolt Brecht, and he said, to talk of trees is treason, because what he felt was important was the central importance of social and political relations. And I think the reverse, that to not talk about trees is treason, because we are assailing the planet in every sphere of our lives. Every wilderness is under pressure from us. if we don't stand on our own ground and trumpet the centrality and importance of nature, then really, why are we in it? So I feel I have a political duty to take some kind of activist role. There are many people doing fantastic stuff, but I add my tiny weight to that because I think it's an important part of my role. And if I didn't, I'd be a dereliction of duty.
And the language that you use in the book is quite interesting because you refer to the animals that live around you as your neighbours.
Yes, well, of course, you know, we are utterly dependent on the other parts of life. We would not exist without fungi, without, you know, I think it's something like $100 billion worth of food is produced by insect pollination. Coffee, cacao, cocoa, chocolate is pollinated mainly by flies. Not just honeybees, you know, it is thousands of insects. Everything about us, everything that we have, all that we are, is part of a collaboration by the other parts of life. And if we think it's just about ourselves, then we are destined to a very swift end. And we have seen massive losses of biodiversity in the last 50 years in my lifetime. So I think it is incumbent on us to try and see that this is a partnership and we need to take account of the other partners to survive. I mean, it's simple self-interest, but it's also really a spiritual and religious duty, because what are we on the planet for if it's not to celebrate the other parts of life? I can't really see much purpose to being here if it isn't to celebrate being part of life.
And this is a respect issue as well, isn't it, for you? I mean, you write in the book about how we respect man-made creations more than natural creations.
Yes, I mean, we love everything that we do ourselves, you know, the gold objects of Tutankhamun, the paintings of Leonardo da Vinci, etc., etc. But a blackbird in your garden will give you an infinite source of inspiration and pleasure and fulfillment, like a work of art. And for me, as life passes, I'm less and less interested in what we create ourselves as in what the other parts of life offer us. So, yeah, I'm devoted to arguing that life itself is really the full mission of being a human being. Of course, that's our life as well. But let's not overlook the contributions of everything else. And, you know, I'm a great lover of writing and music and art, but I could forgo all of that. Nature is everything, really.
And you talked about insects earlier and you're writing about all kinds of insects, but I was interested to read that you're not a great fan of spiders, even though you write about them.
Yes, I am slightly frightened of spiders. My mother had a terrible arachnophobia. And I used to scorn my poor old mother and her terror of them. But actually, I'm not that keen on them myself. Actually, I absolutely adore spiders. I spend a lot of time looking at them and reading about them and studying them. And they are very beautiful. I mean, that's the other thing about them. But we have a visceral fear of things like snakes and spiders, which is hardwired into the human nervous system, which is self-preservation, and they are venomous. But I still love them as well. And spider silk is one of the most extraordinary creations of nature. So I do love them, but I don't want to hold them in my hand.
Well, we're going to hear from Jill Dawson in just a moment, who won the East Anglian Book Award. She's talking about being a judge for the Costa. You won, of course, the East Anglian Book Award. What difference did that make to you?
Well, it was a lovely, I'd been shortlisted four times for other books. And in a curious way, I thought I should have won it for Crow Country because that was the work that had most attention and probably the most complete expression of my practice. But I was absolutely thrilled to be shortlisted for Claxton Diary and to be honoured with the main prize for it. It was fantastic. It's just, how can you put it? You don't write to win prizes, but to have a prize bestowed upon you by your peers, yeah, it's a deep fulfillment. I mean, I was given an honorary doctorate from the University of East Anglia, and I think that's, you know, been the most precious. I call them spiritual royalties. I quite like the real royalties to keep me going. But spiritual royalties are always great. You know, they give you affirmation as an author and a sense that you're doing something right. I think that's the important thing.
Thank you, Mark. Well, let's hear from Jill now. Jill Dawson won the East Anglian Book of the Year Award in 2016 for her novel, The Crime Writer. With 11 novels in total, she's been shortlisted and longlisted many times for the Orange Prizes and many others. She's a founder and director of the Goldust Mentoring Scheme, which matches new writers with established ones. Over the last 12 months, she's been a judge for the 2020 Costa First Novel Award, won by Ingrid Persaud for Love After Love. She's also a member of the final judging panel, which will shortly decide the Costa Book of the Year from the winners of each category. When I spoke to Jill, she started by reflecting on how pleased she was to be asked to play such an important role in the awards that were launched almost 50 years ago.
Very exciting and pleasing, and felt like an opportunity to have a real sort of inside look at how these things happen.
And how many books do you actually have to read for this category?
It does vary from year to year because it's about publishers submitting books. I think there was 140 for the debut category, which was the one I was reading this year. It might be a little bit less for the other fiction category, poetry, all the others, but that's how many is submitted for the Costa First Novelist Award.
And what are you looking for in a book? I mean, do you know straight away, or what are the factors that you're looking for?
I think it's highly subjective, of course, and everyone has to admit that. I was diligent, as I'm sure all judges are, and I read everything. But I did know at once if I loved the voice. So I think in my case, a voice and something fresh, original, something new, something I hadn't read before, perhaps a world I didn't know and felt, haven't seen that before. Those kind of things really grabbed me and were likely to keep me much more hooked. Whereas occasionally I think you feel, I've read a book like this many times. There's nothing fresh here. But we can be surprised. So I diligently read on and sometimes was surprised.
And I suppose reading debut novels, you're not quite sure what you're going to get. So that's quite exciting in a way.
The really nice thing about debut novels is I deliberately didn't read up on the writer. I didn't try to find out what their reviews were, how it was received. Sometimes it's unavoidable. You do recognise a name, but I think much less so than in other categories. And so I felt it was an even playing field, that I could have an open mind. And that did help. And also just that sense of excitement that this might be a real new discovery. Here's someone who's going to make their mark. And I did feel that a few times.
And how did you deal with your own likes and dislikes? That you might have picked up a science fiction novel, for example, and thought, well, this isn't a genre I usually read. How do you put your own likes aside?
The criterion for the Costa is something like, this is a book which has wide appeal. And I think all the judges kept that thought in mind. And if we felt passionate about it, we felt that sort of fulfilled that particular criterion. So we did read things that were outside of our comfort zone, because in fact there was a long list compiled and we shared that with one another. And the discussion was fantastically interesting. And obviously I'm not at liberty to say which those ones were because they didn't necessarily make the shortlist. But I think we were very much open-minded, and it was an exciting discussion and enriching to see other people's choices. I mean, one thing that's interesting in our shortlist is it's all women. We came up with four women. No one mentioned that, I'm very glad to say. No one ever said, oh, is this a problem? It's all women. When women dominate, that's the word they use, a shortlist, people usually think there's some agenda going on, but we chose the books we love.
Because they're not read anonymously, are they? You know who's written them.
Yeah. And also, depending on the publisher, some would be coming with recommendations, if you like, on the proof copy. And some would be very much plainer. And I think it's to do with the stage they're at as well, because you've got the whole year when they come out. So some are already out or about to be out, and some not yet out. You know what I mean? It's a little bit difficult, but that's always the case.
You're happy with the shortlist? It reflects the quality of talent?
Yep. I've got the shortlist here. And I'm able to say this with what we did after we'd had a really getting into it discussion about the books. We then went away and said, right, we're going to put up the four we love best out of this long list, and then we'll fight a bit more, So we went away from each other, sort of turned our back, it was done obviously as a Zoom meeting like this. And then I put my four together and we said, right, ready, steady, go. And we all lifted up our books and they were the same four books. So at that point, we did not argue, which was a great feeling. We felt as if we'd each championed different books that we maybe loved slightly more than others. It is difficult, it's a slightly pained feeling at when you suddenly realise what you're letting go. If we can only have four, what about this one? But interesting, all of the judges chose those four.
Because I suppose some people might say, well, you're looking at good writing and you would recognise good writing. There's also an element of subjectivity in there as well.
There's a huge element of subjectivity. I mean, I've always suspected and I know, and having been shortlisted for the Costa long ago, 20 years ago, it's quite interesting for me to realise that a different group of judges, I'm really, really sure, would have come up with a different group of books. It doesn't mean, how could it possibly, objectively, these are the best this year? That's sort of a nonsense. It kind of means these are the books we judges felt passionately about and really loved and really wanted to recommend. And I somehow feel that's quite liberating to think of it like that, really, to understand that different combinations of judges would have come up with different things.
And as you say, your book's been on shortlists, on various shortlists and up for awards. Has it made you feel differently about that whole process of when your novel's been submitted?
It makes me feel how much an element of luck plays its part somehow. I mean, you may perhaps land in the reading pile of a judge who hates fiction based on real stories, let's say, which is what I do. You know, I think people have their prejudices. They admit them and they try and have an open mind, but of course they influence the decision. I mean, I have championed here, I think, really wonderful writing and beautifully written novels with a strong voice and character, which are things that I notice. Other judges, other readers care much more about different things, if you like, the actual twists and turns in a plot, which for me is much less important. I care a great deal about things feeling true and plausible, and I realise others don't. Judges will come up with different things. It's made me feel much better. And I think the other thing is that once you reach a certain level, I mean, I do remember, and I remember very happily, that on the year that I was shortlisted for the Costa, two other people who were shortlisted with me was Ali Smith and Will Self, and we didn't win. It was Matthew Neal with English Passengers that year. So do you know what I mean? You're in good company. I think it's quite an interesting way for a writer to think, you know what, it's nice, it's icing on the cake. We shouldn't become too obsessed by it, I suppose.
Because it is a responsibility, isn't it? Somebody winning the Costa novel, it makes a difference to their profile and their sales.
It makes a huge difference. I mean, I do wonder whether your reader in a bookshop is as aware of that as we would be. But you see a book heavily promoted, if the publishers now really get behind it and put a lot of money into advertising it, it's likely that the shortlisting for a prize is what prompted that. The hardest thing for me to know was that there were all these books from new writers who really needed, during this difficult year when bookshops weren't open, that extra boost the Costa could provide. So I was very conscious of that, as were my fellow judges.
Because it will have taken you away inevitably from your own writing. It will have interrupted that. Do you get paid for this?
You don't really get paid. It's a kind of token amount to cover the expenses of the judges. But presumably Debbie James, who is a bookseller, was still trying to run the bookshop, and Eric was doing his full-time blogging job. What it takes me away from is my reading. I did manage to do my own writing. But I'm a huge, you know, I'll read about three books a week on a normal basis, as well as work by my students. And so the books I might want to read would often be non-fiction research or just things I want to learn about. And so those are what got parked, and I've got a big to-be-read pile. So it's good if you're already a keen reader, I suppose, and my other judges definitely were.
Because you're reading in a different way when you're judging, I guess. It's not quite such a relaxed way of reading.
No, that's true. And also, I don't know about other people, but I did make notes. I just worried that if I didn't, I wouldn't remember necessarily, you know, what it was that was either turning me off or really drawing me to something. And if some books take a while as well, and you have to sort of allow them that time.
Are you allowed to say, do you have a favourite?
I do have two strong favourites. But then the moment I think of that, I think, oh, no. So actually, I think it's safe to say I feel very passionately about all the books we chose for different reasons. Having then chosen them, of course, at that point, you find out a little bit more about the individual because they're all excited on Twitter or whatever. So it's very pleasing to think that one person, for example, isn't on Twitter and possibly wasn't expecting a great deal during this difficult year for her novels. So I think it's quite a pleasing feeling to know that you can really bring a book to readers' attentions.
And the winner of the Costa Book of the Year will be announced in just 2 days' time on the 26th of January. You can find out more at costa.co.uk. We've been talking today to Mark Cocker about his book, A Claxton Diary, which is published by Vintage. We should talk about Birds Britannica, which has been recently published. It took you 8 years to research this?
Yeah, it took me 3 solid years to write it. It's the shorter of the two big books on cultural significance of birds. Basically, it takes all the birds in Britain and illuminates their cultural place for us. So, for example, things like the robin, which are our national bird, a cherished garden bird, is actually a separate race from the robins of the continent. They're tamer. The way in which they're portrayed on Christmas cards and have a place in our language about Christmas. Why did that come about? Because postmen wore a red uniform and were eventually became known as robins. And it's about all the different ways that all the birds have given us cultural texture and material. You know, you think about skylarks and nightingales, more poetry written about nightingales than any other bird on earth. Skylark runs it a close second in the UK, gave rise to The Lark Ascending by Vaughan Williams, the most popular piece of classical music ever written. So that all originated from this extraordinary vocalization by the Skylark. And so it's a way in which birds shape our cultural life. And, you know, that's one of the stories, really, of Birds Botanica, is if you lose biodiversity, you lose cultural diversity. And the book celebrates the ways in which birds enrich us in so many different ways.
And what's next for you? What are you writing at the moment? What are your plans for publication?
I'm writing a book. It's the most ambitious book I've ever worked on. I'm telling the story of one day through which I retell, in scientific terms, the story of Genesis, the story of all life on Earth, filtered through a single bird, but I'm going to say no more.
And a question we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment?
Just finished reading the first in the 22 novel sequence by an author called Patrick O'Brien. And they're a set of historical novels set in the Napoleonic Wars. The first one will be well known to people because the title was used as the title for the film called Master and Commander, featuring Russell Crowe. But actually, the filmmakers used about five of the novels in a composite way to construct their own story. And this is the first volume. It's actually not as good as some of the later ones, but it is an astonishing tour de force of historical recreation. And it has this fabulous relationship between two men, one of whom is called Stephen Maturin, and he is a physician, but also a very, very keen naturalist. So the book is immersed in natural history, very accurate natural history. I can't quite work out whether I love it and it's a fantastic, the greatest historical novel ever written, or whether it's a kind of covert jingoism for the English. I have mixed views on it, but I do really enjoy them as a kind of, as a sort of light reading, if you like, is what I'd call it.
And I have to point out, Russell Crowe in the film, you can't get away from birds, can you?
Yes, I wouldn't like it if it was any other kind of bird.
Well, we'll come back to you in just a moment, Mark, for your final piece of music. But a heads up that in our next show, our featured guest is Marion Womack, talking about her new novel, The Swimmers. We'll also hear from lawyer Elizabeth Snead discussing her new self-help book about surviving a relationship breakdown. And Lynn Fraser talks about her novel, The Busy Mum's Guide to Getting Away with It. But we'll hear your last choice of music now, Mark, which is Keith Jarrett and Sundial One. Why this one?
Well, again, I've been listening to it since I was 20-odd, and it's a very early piece of Keith Jarrett. He is a child genius, a sort of Mozartian prodigy, who is a jazz pianist, and his great forte is kind of improvised pieces of music. But this is a very early piece of music, and it's one of the most beautiful bits of piano music I know. But there's quite a nice story attached to it, because in the days that we had cassettes, I had my Sony Walkman on, and I was lying in the Thar Desert in Rajasthan in India. And one of the animals that I wasn't too keen to see was sword-scale viper, one of the four most deadly snakes and venomous snakes on the planet. And I felt this sort of rustle as I was listening to Keith Jarrett. And in the morning, I got up and I wear a Norfolk fisherman's smock. And I pulled my smock on and I could feel this animal in my smock on my back. And I was absolutely convinced it was a sword-scale viper. I ran out of my tent wrestling with this smock, thinking this thing was going to bite me at any time. And I threw the smock off. And as the smock hit the ground, a little gerbil ran out across into somebody else's tent, sending them scurrying from their tent. But it was a little mouse-like creature with a long tail weighing about 1 ounce. And this caused me more terror than any other animal I've ever seen. So I always kind of recall that episode when I listen to this fantastic piece of piano music.